This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It is episode 61, and it has been an exciting week. Oh, man, about Sunday, I was working downstairs and trying to do some internet banking, and it was taking a long time. I thought, what is going on? And so then since I'm my own internet service provider, I thought, this doesn't feel right. So I grabbed my handy dandy speed test website. And lo and behold, if I wasn't getting a fraction of what I was supposed to be getting. And so I started chasing it, ended up calling the people that I buy my internet from, and we couldn't figure out what was going on. Eventually, it seemed to settle down a little bit. Finally kind of got loose of that about 6:30 in the evening, which was good because it was Sunday night and we had already decided we were going to watch Lost. And we had one more episode to go before the finale was going to premiere. And so we wanted to get that and watched, and my wife and I had already discussed the fact that we were going to start watching that at 7, so I just came in under the wire there, and we got that watched, and enjoyed Lost, and have our own opinions about the finale, but I'm not really going to talk about that today. You know, everybody has their opinion about the Lost finale, who actually watched it. Anyway, so that was pretty exciting. Well, then Monday, started getting into trouble. Heard from some of my customers that they were having trouble still on Monday with getting internet speeds up, and did some checking around. It appears to be related to something called the backhauls, which I don't actually own at this point. So I've been informing the people we buy our internet from, and they've been reporting that, yes, they've been having some troubles too. And so I've been scampering around in the evenings trying to figure out exactly what's going on. Some days has been better, some days not so good. If I've got my facts correctly, our company we buy our internet from is actually out at my tower even as we speak, replacing some equipment. And, whoa, I have an ambulance going by. I'm stopping here. Okay. I was turning left, and I just started to hear the ambulance. As I was turning left, and all of a sudden, here it came. Anyways, they are out at the tower replacing some equipment. Hopefully that fixes the problem. If it doesn't, then I don't know. It's one of those things that we're just kind of in the midst of the challenge right now and trying to kind of figure out what's going on, and we'll just move forward one step at a time, and Jesus will be with us and we'll get this figured out. So that's been a little exciting. And it sort of encroached on my preparation time. So I'm not nearly as prepared for this today as I like to be, but that's okay. I've got some notes and kind of have an idea of what I'd like to talk about. In other related news, I haven't been able to work much on the super secret project because I've had the encroachment of the internet service provider business, but that's okay. All those things will get done in the appropriate amount of time. In the very exciting news, my daughter her due date is June the 5th, which means we are close now. Before they actually knew she was pregnant, her hubby, who is a youth minister, had already planned a youth retreat for this weekend, the Memorial Day weekend. So he's going to be gone this weekend, and she's going to be coming over to our house. At first she said, oh, it's no big deal, I feel fine. And we said, we don't think so. You are going to come over to our house and stay with us this weekend. It's ridiculous for you to be a week away from your due date and not have anybody there with you. So I'm going by tomorrow morning, I think, if all goes as planned, and we're going to go do some grocery shopping together like we used to do in the old days. And that'll be fun. And then I'm going to take her back to her house and get all her stuff and bring her out to the house. And so she's going to spend the weekend with us, just kind of kicking around a little bit. So that'll be fun. Now then, for today, I've got to kind of get my brain worked around here to actually talk about this and kind of get out of the mode of thinking about all the other things I've been thinking about this week. For today, I had mentioned a couple of weeks ago that I was reading a book called Liar's Poker, and I think I mentioned that I was reading another one called The Big Short. It's interesting because the books are really like a part one and part two. The first book is about the author's experience, says, as a bond trader, salesman, something, Slater, as a bond trader slash salesman slash something. During the 1980s, he actually had studied, I think, art history as part of his post-high school educational experience, and ended up at the right place at the right time, getting interviewed for a job, and ended up working for Salomon Brothers, which was kind of an interesting story. But he spent Liar's Poker basically talking about how the mortgage bond business came into being and what the effects of that were. And I had forgotten, but apparently there was a subprime mortgage crisis in the 90s, and he was around during that time, and so he was writing about that. It's a very interesting book. It's a little dense in spots, but has a tremendous amount of good information about it, and it's very eye-opening as to how the bond and stock companies work and the caliber, quote-unquote, of people who work at these companies. Really very intriguing. Well, The Big Short is sort of part two to that. It's actually, I felt like, more accessible than Liar's Poker was. More stories, more conversational, less technical, although it still has some technical things in it, and he does a good job of explaining, but really focuses on the sub-mortgage practices and bond practices running up to the big deleveraging in 2008 that we all went through. And specifically focuses on the people who saw it coming and actually made bets against it in the bond market and thereby made a lot of money. So, I think there's some interesting things to gather from all of this. There was one point when I was reading Liar's Poker that I literally bust out laughing because it was such an apt example of a simple principle that I have patterned my life after for decades. And that is that no matter what the flesh suggests to you, if you listen to those suggestions and you follow those suggestions, no matter what part of life it's in, you will increase the strength of the flesh in your life across all areas of life. Last week or the week before last, I mentioned a story that I had heard about a Native American talking to his son about the fact that within everyone there are two wolves, and there is an evil wolf and there is a good wolf, and the evil wolf is filled with rage and envy and criticism and hatred, and the good wolf is filled with kindness and generosity and mercy and love and joy. And the young boy had said, "Which wolf wins?" And the Native American father had said, "The one you feed." And that's very, very true. And I have lived by that principle for years, that even though it might feel good to let the flesh run in me, even if it might seem to be, oh, that's just a temporary thing, I'll just be mad for a moment, I'll just criticize for a moment, and then I'll be okay, I'll just walk away from it. In fact, what you're doing is you're creating patterns of behavior that strengthen the flesh within you. And what was fascinating to me about Liar's Poker was the fact that there was one or two men, I can't remember for sure, at Solomon Brothers who really wanted to create a new kind of bond that would be based on mortgages, because there were so many mortgages in the United States. Up to that point, mortgages were just the purview of the savings and loans and little banks, and they weren't really looked at as any kind of a major financial instrument that could be traded. The big reason being, you were never sure when people who had mortgages were going to pay them off. And so, unlike commercial loans that had a term to them and would likely go to term with businesses paying them off, with mortgages, everybody likes the early payment option. And so people who wanted to invest in financial instruments didn't necessarily want to invest in these because they weren't sure how much money they were going to make over the long haul. Well, what the guy at Solomon Brothers figured out is that what he could do is he could gather a lot of these mortgages into an instrument, into a bond, and he could divide it up. Now, the easy analogy for how he divided it up would be to think about a tower built out of these mortgages with artificial floors drawn in this tower. And what would happen is, depending on which floor you invested in, that correlated to how much risk you were taking and how much interest you could make. If you invested in the bottom floor, then it paid a higher percentage of interest, but you were also liable for more of the defaults, and you could have the greater possibility of the loans being paid off early. But as you moved up these floors, you had less and less chance of that happening because the lower floors beneath you would have to be satisfied in terms of money being paid back or defaults. And so they were able then to categorize these floors and rate them differently, top floors being AAA, bottom floors being BBB, which is really low in terms of safety and convenience and all that sort of thing. So once they figured this out and finally started getting people interested in it, Solomon actually reaped the benefits of this, because now suddenly they had a product that nobody else had, and their mortgage bond traders were making money hand over fist. I mean, they were just plowing through the money. Well, what was interesting was they were so ferociously interested in this money, giving vent to their flesh and listening to the flesh convince them that the only thing important is money, that opened up the floodgates of the flesh working in their lives, and at least in my interpretation. And one of the ways that manifested itself within the mortgage department was gluttony, which is a really interesting thing and confusing unless you understand how the flesh works. And it didn't surprise me at all, but the level of their gluttony just astonished me. They would, every morning, send out to a local deli and get a whole tray full of onion cheeseburgers that would arrive at 8 a.m. in the morning. These guys were coming in hungover, not much sleep the night before, and they're wolfing down these onion cheeseburgers. There was stories of one of the traders that would make cartons of malted milk balls just disappear. There was another guy who would send a trainee out to buy $20 worth of candy every afternoon. On Fridays, they would have Feeding Frenzy Friday. And when customers would call, they'd say, "We're sorry, we're in the middle of a feeding frenzy right now. I'm going to have to call you back," because they would order out $400 worth of Mexican food. It's pretty hard to do, except they would get guacamole in 5-gallon tubs and just descend on this food and gorge themselves. And what you have here is a picture of flesh run amok. And of course I could predict the ending of the book, because whenever you let flesh run amok like that, what's going to happen? You are going to come to destruction. So that was some things I pulled out of Liar's Poker. Now then you get to The Big Short. And while you would think that the mortgage subprime crisis in, I think it was the 90s, would have put an end to that, in fact, it didn't. In The Big Short, the author talks about the fact that during the 1990s, a big year for subprime mortgages and bonds was $30 billion. And yet by the year 2000, in the year 2000, they did, hang on a minute, I'm glancing at my notes real quick, $130 billion worth of subprime mortgages were written. By 2005, $625 billion were written, with over $500 billion packaged into bonds. Now then, why is that important? Well, first of all, you are packaging together into bonds subprime mortgages, most of which are highly volatile. And it looks like they are coming down, no, going up on the tower as we speak. So I may need to finish this up quickly. I'm just going to pull into my garage and we'll finish this up quickly, and then I'll go over and see if they need any help. They're climbing up the tower as we speak. Anyways, so what was happening was they were packaging these bonds together, or these mortgages together, in these bonds that I was talking about. And they were getting rated from AAA to BBB based on the risk factors involved. Except the bond companies were not happy with that, because that made some of the bonds less valuable. And so what they did is they took all the bottom floors from these bonds in and packaged them together into something called a CDO. I forgot what it's called, a credit default something or other. Anyways, they packaged them together in yet another instrument. Now, mind you, this instrument is made up of completely sour, triple B rated subprime mortgages. But because they had packaged together so many of these bottom floors, they would go to the rating companies and then say, "Well, see, these are diversified." And the rating companies would actually rate, I'm backing into my garage, they would actually rate about 80% of them now as triple prime bonds. And everybody thought they were safe. Okay, so what The Big Short is about is it's about the fact that there were people that figured this out in the early 2000s. They were very methodical people who were looking and investigating and seeing what was in these bonds, and they figured out the fact that these bond companies were doing this, and the bond rating people were doing this as well. And they finally convinced some of the big financial houses to do what's called a credit default swap against these instruments that they had created that were rated wrong. And what a credit default swap is it's like an insurance policy. And so for cents, mere cents on the dollar, percentages of cents on the dollar, I mean, we're talking about half a cent on the dollar or 0.2 cents on the dollar, you could buy an insurance policy in a credit default swap so that if there was a $10 million bond that was just loaded up with these junk mortgages, you could buy insurance in case that defaulted, which of course it was going to, for fractions of pennies on the dollar per year. So if it was a half a cent, what you would be paying for was a $10 million bond. So $100,000, I think it's $50,000. For $50,000 a year, you could insure a $10 million bond, and if the $10 million bond defaulted, for your $50,000 a year, you got $10 million, even though you didn't own the bond. The author in The Big Short said that this would be like, you know, buying insurance, fire insurance, on a house that was burning. Because these guys had figured out that all of these subprime mortgages with their fixed rates for 2 years or their no payments, no interest for 2 years, all that stuff, they figured out that in 2 years, these things were going south. And the people who figured out, one of these guys, by the time it was all said and done, had like $1 billion in insurance on these bonds. Well, you can imagine when these bonds went south. These guys made a killing. And because there were so many of these credit default swaps and derivatives and everything going, that's why everything just blew up, because all of this money was getting sucked away from these big companies because all the bonds were going bad and they couldn't cover it. And so they were getting close to default. And then, of course, we had the whole situation that we had in 2008, 2009. Now, why am I saying all of this? Well, one of the really interesting things about this book is that the author rehearsed the states of these individuals who had guessed right at the end of the book. And would you expect them to be completely joyous and thrilled and celebrating and all this kind of stuff? In fact, I can't recall that any of them, that I would want to be in the situation that any of them were. Yes, they had made a lot of money. But the stress of going through the whole thing wore on them and wore on them. And one of the guys was running an investment fund, and his investors just pummeled him and beat him up over the fact that his plan wasn't coming about until it did. And they made, you know, 10, 20, 50, 100 times on their money. But it didn't seem to me like anyone really came out of it well. And I think that's because all of them were so focused and so rabid to make money that what happens is when your whole focus is money, as we talked a couple of weeks ago, you end up addicted to it. And when you end up addicted to it, all you're doing is making your flesh stronger. You know, I've shared some of this with some friends. And sometimes the reaction I get from friends is, man, if we could just figure out how to get involved in that, we could make some of that money. But, you know, I don't think that's really the solution. Because at the end of the day, money is just a tool. Mind you, I have no problem making money. But if it becomes your whole focus and you start to lose your connection and your relationships and your joy at going on your epics and your quests, it's just not worth it. So while it's very fascinating to read these books, Liar's Poker and The Big Short, and see how these guys figured it out ahead of time, and, you know, they really did make a killing in the market, I think the takeaway from this is that even those guys that made all that money, it is really not the solution. The solution is and has always been relationship. Relationship with God, relationship with your spouse, relationship with your children, relationship with friends. That's really where meaning comes from in life. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home, and I have to go because I have to go see how the guys are doing on the tower. See you, bye.